Hey there, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. Every week at this time, we do the News Dissector Radio Hour. It's an area of for confrontation, commentary, and discussion. It's a outgrowth of the blog I write every morning at newsdissector.net. A commentary and analysis of media coverage, what's in the media, what's missing from the media. And that's what I try to carry over on this program. And we're going to be joined by the editor of BuzzFlash at Truthout, Mark Carlin, who is a phenomenal writer and commentator online. He's been doing it for many, many years. I'm a great admirer of his, and he's agreed to come on the program. So stay with us here for News Dissector Radio.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning, San Francisco carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
Selling attitude like food for the masses. Junk consumption. We are lumping. Just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched. The bill's attached. Flim flam diagram. Data jam. Handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news goo. What we need to know. News goo.
News goo. A powerful musical critique, shall we say, of media, done some years back by Polarity One, the musician who's been on our program and whose music we play frequently. And now Polarity One himself, Pilar Levine, will be joining me on the air here on News Dissector Radio, bringing his own quirky political views as well as some of his new music. I'm really excited about that because we're going to try to kind of change the show a little bit, energize it a bit in the new year. So thank you, Pilar, for agreeing to be part of it. Thank you to Progressive Radio Network for carrying it. There's a call-in number, 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. If you want to talk with my guests or challenge me or share some information, you can listen on the phone at 832-280-0066. That's 832-280-0066. And there's a toll-free number as well, 877-627-5065. Here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. So we want to welcome now, unfortunately the orchestra is off, Mark, so I don't have any actual trumpets that I can call on to, herald your coming on the air, but I'm happy that you're joining me here. I read your work regularly, and I respect it a great deal. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks, Danny. It's an honor. I've followed your work for years, as you know. And particularly in the last couple of weeks, it's inspired me in terms of, I think, three columns I've written about what you called in your book. In fact, you had yellow police tape wrapped around your book in a way. The crime scene on Wall Street and how it's gone unprosecuted.
Well, you know, first of all, before we get into the issues, just let's tell folks a little bit about you and your work, because you're based in Chicago. BuzzFlash is something you created into a major website, and then you've joined up with Truthout. How's that going? Tell us about what you're actually doing and where people can find your work.
It's going quite well. Truthout is a wonderful publication. I highly recommend to any of your listeners who aren't aware of it. And has a very dedicated staff. It's been around just a little less than BuzzFlash. BuzzFlash was started in May of 2000, and Truthout the next year. And it's really a good combination. Truthout tends to have longer, more in-depth stories, and BuzzFlash is 24/7, and what it offers is access to about 190 articles at a time that you can click through, and we pick the best ones of the day and then you can read articles from an infinite number of sources. But in addition to that, at BuzzFlash, the truth out, which is you can get to, the easiest way is buzzflash.org, or to go to truthout.org, and on the top you'll find how to get to BuzzFlash commentary. And it's on the BuzzFlash commentary that I write a commentary 5 days a week, and we post commentaries from different people from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, I want to just, say that the reason I'm inviting Mark on and other colleagues is that it's important for independent media outlets that have so much to say to also cross-promote each other, to talk a little bit about what each other is doing, to try to call attention to their work. It's not easy being out there and competing against very well-funded big media organizations that often tend to take the same narrow view on every issue. So to have BuzzFlash and Truth Out and some of the other outlets that I've brought to your attention over the many weeks and months that we've been doing this show, this is to me something important. It's not just to recognize good work, but it's to try to get us to realize that we can actually find colleagues, people who are very simpatico with what our values are and what we care about online, and we can support those sites as well. And Mark Harlan's work over the years has been just outstanding in that respect. Incidentally, Mark, just to mention this to you before we get into some of the detail here, is that our mediachannel.org, which is what we started in 2000 as well, is coming back online, hopefully by next week, with a wide range of articles about the media. And you know, that's also part of an effort to call attention to other perspectives, to other writers, to voices that are important, but also to focus a little bit on the inadequacies and flaws of our media system, so that not only can you see what's wrong with our media, but also you can read people who have really done a tremendous amount of work researching, writing, investigating, and offering perspectives that are thoughtful, that are contextualized, that have background to them, that know something about the world. And so there is in our media system voices that are important for all of us to know about. And that's part of my kind of, you know, thing, so to speak. And I also believe that this has to be done on a global basis, because there are so many people writing globally, internationally, who have important things to say, who are not household words in America. I, for one, write for Al Jazeera, aljazeera.com, which, you know, does an excellent job of offering a diverse range of perspectives. And it's a website that's actually, I think, bigger in terms of readership than the New York Times website. So, you know, it's not that, you know, these are marginal exercises. Actually, they're very well-read and well-respected all over the world. It's just that in the United States and in the U.S. media, where there's such a narrow, parochial, provincial attitude, voices from other countries and journalists who have a lot to say are not really given the respect or visibility that they're due. And this is part of what I try to highlight on our program on News Dissector. And please join me on the phone if you'd like to at 888-874-4888. And also pass the word on about this program, which is airing every week at 5 p.m. on Thursdays here on PRN FM. Now, you've been looking into the Department of Justice also, and you took a really interesting angle in a recent piece. You compared the way Wall Street gets away with murder, if you will, financial murder, and the focus on prosecuting, hounding Aaron Swartz, really the fighter for internet freedom, who took his own life because of all the pressures on him and prosecution and persecution by our own Department of Justice. So tell me a little bit about what you found in writing this piece.
The title of that piece, I think, explains a lot about what we've been writing about. It was, while Department of Justice let financial criminals go free, they pursued Aaron Swartz to death. And literally, he suffered from depression, and it seems pretty clear he committed suicide when he was in a valley of depression. But the precipitating factor, there's usually a precipitating factor, and in this case, it appears to be the unrelenting and tenacious, almost like the inspector in Les Miserables, beyond any reasonable standard of Aaron Swartz for standing up for internet transparency and downloading some files in en masse, which were available through a library owned by MIT. And MIT settled the incident with Aaron, but the U.S. attorney in Massachusetts chose to pursue him and insist on jail time as though the Department of Justice was performing some great act of justice.
Yeah, it's the way these prosecutors like to put some notches on their belts to show their fellow prosecutors how tough they are, how committed they are to upholding the law as they define it and they see it. And this is a case of somebody who was welcomed by the liberal and progressive community as a prosecutor, an Obama appointee, and yet, has sort of taken this case almost like pursuing the great white whale, pursuing Aaron Swartz. I wanted to read a little bit of how you start this commentary, because it's so well written and so important. It says, the status quo managerial elite, consisting of the political and financial masters of the universe, cannot tolerate progressive advocacy that threatens to redistribute power or wealth. That is why police across the nation were instructed to crush the Occupy movement, to pummel it into dust as a public occupation of space, and more importantly, to remove its message of grassroots power and wealth redistribution from the headlines of the media. Those in the driver's seat of the nation fear empowering activism such as Occupy as if it were a virulent contagion that might rapidly spread across the population and infect the public with dangerous ideas of financial and political justice. These are the words of Mark Carlin, who's on the phone with me now. So, Mark, you wrote this piece, but you make a further link. You're not just talking about Aaron's case or this judge, but you're putting it in the context of what the Justice Department has not been doing, namely chasing financial criminals.
Yes, and again, I owe much to you. I watched both the DVD version, and as you know, we offered it free on BuzzFlash. BuzzFlash was still separate from Truth Out at the time, and also your book. We offered them both because I felt that it was very compelling, the case you made. And as you pointed out, and you in the film interviewed people like our good friend Naomi Prinz, that Wall Street, as we started this, and I'm just repeating you, this is from you, is a crime scene.
Well, that means you have a good source, Mark, if you're just repeating me.
Well, also, talking to you, Danny, I don't have to footnote it.
Yeah.
Because you're right here. So, and if I state it wrong, you can correct me. So the reality is you're absolutely right, and we're seeing this more and more. Nothing has changed. Today I wrote a column about Jamie Dimon, who, as most people know who follow the Wall Street, I call them in the column today the made men, of the Wall Street DC sort of ruling elite mafia.
Cabal,
and these
yeah.
people are made men because they are allowed to get away with anything because they have been accepted into the ruling elite. And they can literally do no wrong. So Jamie Dimon, who is head of CEO of JP Morgan Chase, his bank has been found guilty by the Security and Exchange Commission and others, first of all, trading with Iran in violation of the sanctions, which is the, basically a seditious act. you know, but because he's on Wall Street, he gets the bank gets a minor fine. But more than that, as Marcy Wheeler has pointed out, Marcy Wheeler of Empty Wheel, which used to be on Fire Dog Lake, recently they've been chastised, the J.P. Morgan Chase, for violating and continuing to violate without putting in any security measures the Bank Secrecy Act, Anti-Money Act, which was meant to, part of it was meant to control money laundering, therefore reducing the amount of money that terrorists or drug cartels could put into banks. And yet, J.P. Morgan Chase was just formally admonished in writing by the U.S. Controller, Office of the Controller of the Currency, for not complying with the Bank Secrecy Act and Anti-Money Act. And
you know, this whole story is also told in another phenomenal website called NakedCapitalism.com.
Yes.
Which goes into detail. It's actually reprinting it from yet another website, but reprinting this whole story of Jamie Dimon and what have you. And what you talk about, you know, is really important. It's sort of selective prosecution. Who is it that the Department of Justice applies its standards to? And, you know, they have one legal doctrine for Wall Street, another for everyone else. And this U.S. attorney in Boston, Carmen Ortiz, who's the one who unrelentingly, in your words, pressed for a prison sentence for Swartz, stated, quote, very sanctimoniously and very self-righteously, stealing is stealing, whether you use a computer command or a crowbar, whether you take documents, data, or dollars. It's equally harmful to the victim, whether you sell what you have stolen or give it away. Okay? Now, this is a justification and rationalization. If you listen to it, it sounds, you know, somewhat credible. Yes, stealing is stealing, except the application of the standards on who to prosecute and who not to prosecute is extremely selective. And it's like the people who get prosecuted are often the small fry, the people who, you know, are not setting industry patterns, and what have you. And I just read this, I've been reading this volume by Oliver Stone and his colleague about the you know, untold history, the people's history of American foreign policy and secret history of the United States. And he talks about the history of J.P. Morgan before it merged with the Chase Bank, and the role it played over the years as a tool of American intervention, imperialism, the Philippines and many other countries. So there's a long history behind all of this, which, of course, very rarely makes it into the media.
Absolutely. And in the column today, I point out, you know, the violations of a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase tend to be, like, should we say, too large to prosecute? the bank too big to fail? Jamie Dimon, too much a golfing partner of President Obama and a respected testifier on Congressional Hill? He's kind of the star of Wall Street. You know, he's supposed to be the one that's running a so-called clean bank. And yet, he is dealt a card of impunity. Nothing can touch him legally. And when they give out these fines to Wall Street banks, that is, either the Department of Justice or the Security and Exchange Commission, for violating laws. For instance, they fined HSBC over $1 billion recently and made a big deal of that as though they were being harsh. Well, first of all, that's just about 1 or maybe 1.5 months' profit. Second of all, it comes out of the profit of the bank. Now, what was HSBC? We're moving from Jamie Dimon a second to HSBC. What were they prosecuted for? They were they weren't prosecuted. What were they fined for? That was a big mistake to say they were prosecuted, because that's the story. They weren't prosecuted. They were let off with this fine. What were they fined for is the correct way to say it, and not prosecuted for. And that was that they had been engaging in such large scale money laundering with drug cartels, with terrorist-associated banks in Saudi Arabia, I believe, with Iran, too. It was so large scale that one of the big cartels in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel, knew the size of the teller cages at HSBC in Mexico, and they would bring these suitcases of cash. This is all true. This is in the filing relation to the fine, full of cash, $100 bills to banks in Mexico, HSBC banks. And HSBC, you know, obviously knew this. They didn't report it to the government as required by law. And they were cut down their enforcement division relating to the Bank Secrecy Act and Anti-Money Act at a time when the government told them to increase it. And they clearly cut it down so then they could say, well, we really didn't have the number of people to monitor this. But the government, in essence, said they did this knowingly. And yet they got a fine. No one at HSBC was charged with any criminal misconduct in this case. And you're talking about dealing with Iran. You're talking about dealing with banks that finance terrorists. Yeah. And they got a slap on the wrist. It's the same thing with Jamie Dimon. So what did the U.S. government, the Department of Justice, prosecute? People like this cashier, Mr. Gasparian in Los Angeles, who runs a check cashing company, a currency exchange.
Well, you know, this is an example of the disproportion and selective nature of the prosecution. But I want to, you know, you also have a piece up which is really a piece praising President Obama for having the guts to take on the NRA and for taking a stand. And you know, you're suggesting that he's actually putting his life on the line, given some of the fanatics in the NRA and some of the people who are part of this whole gun culture and see guns as the, you know, end all and be all of American freedom. You know, that this having their guns is the most important thing in their lives in many cases. And, you know, you express a fear, I think a real fear, that this could put President Obama's life at risk. Now, I want to say that because we got to make certain distinctions about things with politicians that we really don't like and some things that we have to admire, if reluctantly. And here, you know, the president seems to be taking a stand on an issue, maybe not going as far as you and I would like him to go, but he is taking a stand for control of guns.
Yes, that's true. We bash Obama quite a lot and are quite critical of him on Buzz Flash. And here was a situation where unexpectedly to me, and I used to work quite actively nationally on the gun control issue. I was a bit taken aback at the passion. And, you know, politics, as we know, Danny, is so to a great degree theater. I mean, the 23 executive actions have some significance. They're generally pro-law enforcement, and a lot of people think the NRA is the friend of law enforcement, but they're not. They regularly get Congress to pass laws that are anti-law enforcement when it comes to guns. These are pro-public health, and the NRA is anti-public health. And so they're good as far as they can go. The president, any president, is so hemmed in because the NRA has passed such ironclad legislation that it's very difficult to achieve much meaningful change on the gun front by executive action. But I think, with the exception of one thing, I think Obama could have also banned the importation of parts for assault weapons. And right now, the Secretary of the Treasury is able to do that. and Obama didn't do that, and I think they could have done that. We, in short, a lot of our assault weapons come from overseas.
So they could have done more than they're doing. By the way, Mark, stay, if you can, stick around, okay, into the second half hour here, because we're just opening up these issues, and I really think they're important.
Sure.
So now you were saying that he could have done more, but still...
But as we know, and as I just mentioned, and you and I know from the years, so much of politics is political theater. You know, what is the public stance? And given that Obama generally has had a figure as a somewhat wobbly when it comes to being decisive and firm in relationship to the right-wing loonies, and given that he's tried always to, not always, but generally to be so conciliatory, it was kind of a pleasant surprise that he yesterday was so impassioned and took a stance that took on the NRA instead of trying to appease them and be mealy-mouthed about, you know, we're going halfway.
And they attacked him as a hypocrite. They cited Secret Service protection of his children as an example of him being a hypocrite and all the rest of it. I mean, it's very nasty and very personal, these attacks of theirs.
Yes, that's the way they are, because what their game is intimidation. After all, I've talked to many politicians over the years, and when you get into their offices, both on the national level and the state level, and you talk to them, they go, look, I'm really behind you, but hey, these guys have come in my office and they have guns. And the President of the United States, particularly the first black president, you know, faces a lot of deranged paranoia that the NRA is like a match on gasoline. And we just don't know when one of these nuts, the Timothy McVeigh type, or the people who shot, the type of people who shot JFK, RFK, and MLK in the 60s, and you go back to the civil rights movement and remember that period, and shattered the liberal dream of that decade, led us into the Nixon era through assassination, basically. That we don't know when one of these people is going to come out of the woodwork. And for Obama, the public presentation, let's not deal with, you know, how far he could go or whatever, but the public presentation and his indomitable stance against the National Rifle Association and against the excesses of the gun lobby yesterday was really, for a president who has seemed very weak-kneed and afraid of confrontation, was a profile in courage, because he is literally, as I had him in the headline, putting his life on the line.
Yeah, and of course, you know, there are people on the left, there's progressives, who point to his promoting drones, promoting wars in many countries, exporting weapons around the world and all the rest of it, you know, to question Obama on a whole other level. But, you know, what you're saying here is true. I mean, in a sense, he's taken a stand where it's not clear he had to take that stand. And it certainly shows that the NRA has been inflamed by it, okay? The NRA is not, you know, saying, okay, well, we can work together and figure out something reasonable, blah, blah, blah. No, no, no. They are ready to go to war. And are already going to war against Obama. This is a very dangerous environment that we're all in right now. And who knows, you know, the paranoia of all of this. One of the most interesting articles I saw was by Tom Hartman, and I'd like to talk to you about this in the second half hour. Talks about the Second Amendment was really a way to support slavery. And we'll get into that in the next half hour. I'd also like to hear from you at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, as we talk and continue our conversation with Mark Carlin, the editor of BuzzFlash at Truthout, who's very kindly agreed to join us today. These are important websites, but his ideas are important. Stay with us.
Wells Fargo.
traveled across this country, from shore to shining shore, and it really made me wonder all the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer who could not pay his loan. I heard the auction hammer knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the weary miners lose their lives in some dark hole, while the owner makes his fortune on that cheap non-union coal. But the banks are made of marble with a guard.
Well, that's an updated version of a folk song that I first heard and read about in what was called the People's Songbook so many years ago now. I don't want to embarrass myself by telling you, but it certainly is an important set of issues to talk about this financial crisis. And, you know, in some respects, the gun issue, which was never even part of the Obama campaign, has sort of supplanted a lot of the economic crisis issues that really demand and deserve our attention. But nevertheless, you know, we're dealing with a political economy here in which weapons and certainly the military, but also the private gun industry plays a very big role. And it's not surprising that the opposition to even the most minor accountability and reform and, you know, some sort of, I mean, you got to get a license to drive a car. You have to, you know, fill out some forms. I mean, people are buying weapons with no scrutiny whatsoever. And now we have this situation where the Second Amendment seems to have displaced the First Amendment. It's displaced the Fourth Amendment. Every other amendment somehow doesn't pale in significance because there's such a large lobbying movement that keeps talking about the Second Amendment. What is that Second Amendment, as you understand it, Mark? And what is it that we are being asked to do?
First, just to give some context, because I think this is really important, we all took American history and we got a certain narrative. Bob Peary of Consortium News calls that in his new book, American Stolen Narrative, the one we were given. And one of the things that most of us don't recall, and may have slipped by in the lessons or slipped by in our memory, is that for over the first decade of the American nation, after the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the Constitution didn't exist. The governing document, the legal governing document of then the colonies, independent Britain, was the Articles of Confederation. There was no constitution until over a decade later when a constitutional convention was held. And it was then that a constitution was drafted, approved, and went to the states for confirmation. But that was over a dozen years later before the U.S. had a constitution. It really began with the Articles of Confederation. Now, why is this important? Bob Peary argues that the Constitution was a reaction by, among many people, but most importantly George Washington, to the looseness of the Articles of Confederation, and that states were acting as sovereign powers. And so the Constitution was put together to create a stronger federal government. And again, the stolen narrative by the white right is, that, first of all, the implication that the Constitution existed contemporaneous with the founding of America, and second of all, that the Constitution is a guarantor of states' rights over federal rights. States' rights have always been the battle cry of the South. And this is where it gets connected with race and Tom Hartman's piece on Truth Out, which, by the way, is one of the an article that's in the pantheon of all-time read Truth Out articles. It's way over 200,000 readers now, and it's got a whopping 51,000 likes on Facebook. And what Tom Hartman says, the title of the article is The Second Amendment Was Ratified to Preserve Slavery. And that may seem shocking first as an alternative to America's stolen narrative. But Tom makes a very strong case that what happened was when Washington and others, Jefferson and Madison, got together to promote this idea of replacing the Articles of Confederation with the Constitution, the Constitution was written, and then to placate a lot of different constituencies, the amendments were attached, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. And the reason the Second Amendment was put in there, according to Hartman, was because the South had what were called slave patrols. There were occasional uprisings of slaves against their condition as being human property and their abused positions, often tortured, sold, and so forth. And in fact, Tom mentions the example in the 1750s of the requirement in Georgia that laws were passed requiring all plantation owners or their male white employees to be members of the Georgia militia, and those armed militia members to make monthly inspections of the quarters of slaves in the state. The law defined which counties had which armed militias, even required armed militia members to keep a keen eye out for slaves who may be planning uprisings. And he goes on to discuss further examples of this notion of these slave militia patrols in the South. And his argument is that the Second Amendment was put in there as a concession to the Southern colonies because they did not want to have to disband these slave patrols within their states, obviously composed of white males, and that is what is referred to in the Second Amendment. Yeah. And
well, you remember, Mark, don't you, when the Black Panther Party began talking about arm yourself or harm yourself and began actually parading in Oakland, California with weapons, the reaction of law enforcement, the reaction against people, blacks arming, you know, in America and self-defense was shocking. The people were shocked by this. So there's always been a racial component to this whole debate about weapons and arm, you have a situation today where, you know, symbolically here we have a black president who is being talked about, you know, and challenged in language and in kind of with a spirit that goes back to the slave days.
You're absolutely right. The racial component of the gun issue cannot be underemphasized. It needs to be overemphasized. It is very important to understand, as Tom Hartman points out in this, you know, record-breaking article on Truth Out, that the Second Amendment was created to placate, in essence, the Southern states who still saw themselves as a sovereign states, that really under the Articles of Confederation, it was Washington's fear based on what he saw in the first decade of America's independence that these states were seeing themselves as like a European Union, a confederation of nations as opposed to United States.
You know, and so this is before, we should point out, the Civil War. This is before the movie Lincoln. This was before, the movie Django. Okay? This
but happened. It laid the groundwork for the Civil War in that under the Articles of Confederation and then continuing under the Second Amendment, states saw these state militia, southern states, as a way to suppress and ensure that basically there wouldn't be a southern-wide slave revolt.
But this is
right.
Not inconsistent, though. With, you know, the way this is interpreted today, it's really they've taken the idea of group rights, you know, of people having militias and organizing in groups, and they've, you know, made it an individual right, that individuals have the right to buy as many guns as they want, carry as many guns in some instances as they want, and all the rest of it. And that's a sort of we're kind of redefining what the circumstances were of the Second Amendment in the first place.
That's right. The Constitution and the Second Amendment were meant to ensure the tranquility of the sovereign nation of the United States. Whereas the gun proponents today make the Second Amendment out to be to ensure the right of people to revolt,
against a repressive government. I mean, you're from Chicago, Mark. I'm weekly on Reverend Jesse Jackson's radio show, and one of the regulars on the show is a gun person, you know, from South Carolina, and his whole argument is that we have to have guns in order to defend ourselves against a repressive or brutal, illegal acts by government. Okay, now that issue has not really been raised. I mean, you know, nobody's talked about massive illegal surveillance. Nobody's talked about, collusion between banks and government agencies. No one's talked about the way the whole system has been structured to benefit the 1%, you know, as an oppressive, problem. You know, they talk about rebelling against the government as if the government is out there trying to repress them, which I don't think it really is it?
No, and the notion, again, of why the Second Amendment was put in there, there's an additional point. Tom's story is a very important one significant and shocking insight into the true history of the Second Amendment, but there are other additional factors. And shortly before the Constitution was drafted, again, we're already 10 years into the United States of America under this document called the Articles of Confederation before the Constitution comes along. And one of the reasons that the first president of the United States, Washington, wanted the Constitution to replace the Articles of Confederation was an event occurred in western Massachusetts called the Shays Rebellion. And it was a rebellion against the national government, the state of Massachusetts, and the national government, based on issues that the many residents there felt weren't being addressed. And it was an armed rebellion. It was an attempt to break away from a very nascent United States of America or United Colonies at that time. And George Washington was appalled that wealthy people in Massachusetts had to put up money to hire soldiers to finally suppress the Shays Rebellion.
Well, I happen to have done a television program about this with the historian Eric Foner, one of the top American historians, and it's called Who Rules America? It's based on the arguments of C. Wright Mills in the 60s, the sociologist, about the power elite. And this is a series that you can, if you go to YouTube and put in Who Rules America, you'll see some of our articles. This is the second program dealing with the Shays Rebellion. And I went out to Western Massachusetts. I went out to the very place where it's commemorated. The end of the rebellion is commemorated. And people from the local area go out there and put the American flag in memory of Daniel Shays and the people who stood up. Because what was happening was the big banks were then controlled by the British, and they were foreclosing on the property of the people who had been in the colonial army, who had fought against, who had fought for the revolution. And so many of them saw this as a fight for the values of the American Revolution. It's a fascinating history, and my series, Who Rules America, should interest you, Mark, and others. I mean, you're living in Chicago. Every weekend in Chicago, there's a sort of a death count.
That's right. It's a
tell me about that. What does that feel like? I mean, every weekend to face this body count of dead young people.
That's absolutely correct, and you know, there are so many issues here, but and you're right. Chicago last year went back up. It had declined for a while, the murder rate due to guns, but it went back up. And let's remember, 10,000 are killed every year in the United States. Many more with guns through homicides. And you have another maybe 18,000 suicides, and then you have your accidental deaths. You have about 40,000 deaths a year.
40,000. Let's just take a deep breath and hear that number. 40,000 deaths.
And that far exceeds, obviously, any acts of terrorism. 2 years exceed those. Any 2 years exceed the number of soldiers killed in Vietnam. You know, the number killed in Iraq-Afghanistan war pales by comparison to 1 year of gun deaths in the United States. So, yes, they are very large in Chicago. I just want to go back to a point you raised, which I think is so on target and so important to remember. The gun owner movement is primarily white Christian males. Again, we're talking about race here. And they feel dispossessed by the sharing of power, even though we may criticize Obama for being too corporate, too cozy with Wall Street. They just see him as black, and they see women on the Supreme Court, and the privileged role of the white male on the perch of power has been challenged, even if in many ways nothing's changed militarily a whole lot. As you pointed out, Obama has a kill list, the drones, and so forth. It's symbolic. I mean, race is in many ways symbolic. It's judging a person by the color of their skin.
I mean, what is your take of on the psychology of all this? I mean, you're in a city. Rahm Emanuel was Obama's chief of staff. He's now the mayor, you know, of Chicago. Obama comes out of Chicago. He started as a community organizer, and you know, I work with Saul Alinsky myself personally. You know, this was a considered, you know, wrote the book Rules for Radicals. You know, he wasn't that radical, but still, he was about empowerment of poor and working class people. And
well, that is radical to the ruling elite, and that's why Jamie Dimon or HSBC has a get out of jail free card, while they have their own code of silence. My quick take on it, and I don't mean to be superficial, but if you get back again to the race issue, most of the people killed each weekend in Chicago are black or Latino. And again, you can argue that these large swaths of urban areas, if you look at Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, and even certain areas of Los Angeles, for instance, are really abandoned plantations in a way. And so the country doesn't really care about gun control until there's a mass shooting of whites, and in this case, Newtown at Sandy Hook, of children. But every year, tens of thousands of non-whites are being shot. Remember, a lot of the victims survive, they're injured. It's estimated that for every person killed, there's 10 or 9 or 10 injured. with Ebola. So we really have plantation politics still existing in gun control, where the gun owners who are most vociferous are white Christian males who feel this is their country and that the gun really is they worship the gun. And as you pointed out, there are so many more threats from the government to the average citizen, including the average white male citizen, particularly the rural poor citizen who is a gun worshiper.
And also, a lot of these people are the people who go out and kill their families. They go out and kill
true.
People, you know, in these massacres and movie theaters and other places. These are not...
That's true. Your mass murderer is almost always a white person. But... I would also point out, Danny, and this is important to remember, that in this day and age, Shay's Rebellion aside, because then it was like firearm to firearms, if the government is really going to suppress someone from a military or an arms standpoint, you're going to be dealing with tanks, with F-16s, with bazooka guns, with drones.
Yeah, we're talking about the militarization of the police in America. I mean, these people are armed. This is an army that we're dealing with. And even when there's nonviolent protests and people simply, you know, in a park in lower Manhattan, challenging Wall Street, they just came in and destroyed the whole place and arrested all these people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you're an individual gun owner and you somehow think that you've got like a rabbit's foot because you've got this powerful handgun, it's going to be nothing against the military power of the state and the police force, as you point out. So this is like a fantasy fetish among gun owners that somehow these guns are protecting them from an oppressive force while the oppressive force is keeping them oppressed, particularly rural Appalachian whites.
And who benefits from this, of course, are the gun companies, okay? These are corporations that are making money off of promoting fear and insecurity and selling these products to people so they can have some momentary empowerment on a weekend and go to the range and shoot off some bullets. You know what I mean? This is a psychotic behavior. This is not something that is rational, really, in any way. But when you talk to these people, you can't really raise these deeper issues because they go right after you. You're not a patriot. You're not.
Well, I have to say, I was debating gun control once, and I pointed out, which I often did for many years in many different settings. This was a community suburban setting, and I point out that anyone at a certain moment, if a gun was near, could get mad enough to shoot someone. And afterwards, a guy came up to me and he said, "Did you say that anyone has the potential to shoot someone?" I said, "Basically, yes." And he leaped on me and started to strangle me, shouting that I was insulting him by saying that he had the potential to shoot someone and that he was in complete control of his emotions. I kid you not.
And so this violence is simmering beneath the surface and can be sparked. And this is why your fears about the safety of the president, your fears about maybe the safety of our country, you know, are not illegitimate. They're not, you know, out there. They're not paranoid. Very realistic. And, you know, we're in a situation now where even though this issue may not be, in my mind, the central issue facing America right now, given the depression that we're in, given the joblessness that so many people are experiencing, given the growing poverty, given all of these issues, okay, but somehow this more symbolic issue has displaced them all. But the people who are opposing any kind of rational discourse and discussion of all of this are people who are, you know, one sort of small step away themselves from being violent. And that's what's so scary about it. It's not abstract. It's emotional. It's real.
Absolutely. And what was the reaction to Sandy Hook? The gun lobby and the gun manufacturers put out the rumor which has plagued the Obama administration even before he was sworn in 2009, that Obama was going to somehow ban all assault weapons, which he doesn't have the power to do.
Yeah, he's going to take away our guns, you know.
And so there was a run on assault weapons like never before. This was the reaction of gun owners to the Sandy Hook massacre. And this is a complete fallacious rumor that was meant to stimulate gun sales, and it did.
Well,
and so assault weapons sold out in many places around the country.
So we have to leave
no rationality, but
we have to leave it here. Mark Carlin, thank you so much for being on. I haven't chatted with you in a while, and it's great to have you on and in such good form. You know, you write for BuzzFlash at Truth Out. Please follow his work and his commentaries are brilliant. I appreciate you coming on. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Read my blog at newsdissector.net. Mediachannel.org is coming back. I appreciate your support. I appreciate your listening. Stay with us in the future when we're back again next week. Same time, same station. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, saying please have a safe week after this discussion.
Some of the leaves.